From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Kimberly Atkins, Chief Washington Reporter at the Boston Herald, and this is On Point. When Hurricane Maria struck last September, Puerto Rico took some of the worst. Homes from the mountains to the coast shredded. Roads and power lines stripped away. When it was over, officials said the human toll was 64. Almost everyone suspected those numbers were low, and now a new study says the true toll was in the thousands. Hurricane season starts up again tomorrow, and the island isn't ready. This hour on Point, Hurricane Maria's real toll and getting ready for the next one. You can join us on air or online. Did you believe the official count? Were you or your family there? And did the numbers change the way you think about the government's responsibility? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first from San Juan, the island's capital, is David Begno, a correspondent for CBS News. David, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Kim. Good to be with you.
Thank you. So start us out by telling us what you're seeing where you are there as a new hurricane season is upon us.
I'm seeing what appears to be officials who say they're ready, doing what they can to show us that they're ready. In fact, within the last 24 hours, FEMA took us to a warehouse that was stockpiled with water and diapers, food, and blue tarps. They showed us other areas where they didn't show us the poles that are lined up, but we've been told that there are poles and generators that are stockpiled, preparations that have been made for another storm. Look, Kim, the bottom line is the electrical grid, for example, here is so fragile that if a tropical storm were to come in, it could be a death blow because the grid is in such poor condition. I mean, literally, I think the quote this morning was, it's just all tattered up. Because the repairs that have been made since Hurricane Maria have been repairs with broken poles and lines that were on the ground. They couldn't get new equipment in some places, so they had to use the broken equipment that was there. Even the governor of the island has said the grid is in the worst shape. So all the repairs that have been made to restore power back to people have been made sort of, you know, metaphorically with bubble gum and duct tape here and there. The Army Corps of Engineers has left. PREPA, the power authority, is on its own now. They're using a few subcontractors. But as I talk to you right now, we are heading toward Yabucoa, where the storm made landfall on September 20th last year. And there are still about 11,000 people without power, and they haven't had it for 8 months.
Wow. David, I want to play a montage of some of your coverage during your extensive reporting trip in Puerto Rico last September as that Category 5 Hurricane Maria slammed into the island, and we'll talk about it on the other side.
The winds are ferocious right now, gusting above 120 miles per hour. The communication has been cut. Power is out. Folks here aren't even able to reach relatives. Even the hospitals need help. There's only one operating room that's functioning right now. These are Americans sitting in line, sleeping in their car, desperately trying to get fuel. The first person we saw when we got here was the mayor, and he said, go anywhere and you will find destruction.
David, at that time, did you realize that this could be a historic storm?
It took a few days, Kim, because we couldn't even get out to put our own eyes on the actual destruction. I remember the storm made landfall. We hunkered down in our hotel and we tried to figure out where we could go. We drove around San Juan and we probably got a quarter of a mile. The power lines were down everywhere. We were worried about running out of fuel, couldn't get in touch with any government official, didn't see a police officer anywhere other than at our hotel where they were taking shelter. It took a good 48 to 72 hours to even realize how bad it was. In fact, I remember a colleague from another network said they were actually packing up and sending crews home. And within about 24 hours, he called back to say, oh, we're actually sending 15 more people in.
Wow.
It took a minute just to get a real assessment of how bad it was.
And so now we have this new study that we'll get into in more detail a little later on. But I just want to ask you, were you surprised at the death toll being estimated by this Harvard study as being over 4,000 people?
I was surprised that the government appeared somewhat shocked. I was surprised that the government didn't even know the study was being performed. Now,
the folks with Harvard say, you know, this had nothing to do with the government. Harvard put up $50,000 and we did it in 6 weeks and we didn't ask the government for data and the government wasn't going to provide us data anyway because they said they've shut that down for the time being. So I was surprised at, I was also surprised to hear the mayor of San Juan say she was shocked that people weren't protesting in the streets. She was nearly in tears when I interviewed her. Now, granted, Carmen Yulín Cruz is a controversial, polarizing figure who, you know, you've got people who love her and people who can't stand her. But the bottom line is the woman speaks her mind. And she was one of the first ones to say, how is it that people aren't up in arms? I'll tell you this. I can't speak for the people of Puerto Rico. I've said multiple times I had never been here before the storm, and I don't think I knew someone who was Puerto Rican. Having gotten to know these people over the last 8 months and seen their resilience in the face of disaster, I've also come to understand that they have consistently felt like second-class citizens. Mm. They have consistently felt underestimated, and they have consistently come to expect that they will be forgotten by the U.S. government and by other folks who simply overlook Puerto Rico. And I think that may be part of the reason why we on the mainland are aghast at the figure. But when you go around Puerto Rico, many people will say to you, I'm not surprised.
So share a little bit more about what you're hearing from those people. I mean, we know the folks who did this study went to Puerto Rico and talked to people about their experience in order to sort of gauge what the real human toll was. What were you seeing? Was it the fact that people couldn't access medical care? Was it the quality of water? What was the biggest problem these people were facing?
Interesting that you asked that, because we started our day yesterday trying to figure out how can we tell the stories of the forgotten, the people who say they were forgotten. So we went to Harvard. Harvard said, we're not going to tell you who we talked to. It's part of the privacy of this study, and we don't even have the information. That sounded a little weird. So I said, you know what? We've got 300,000 people on Facebook. Let's reach out to them and see who wants to tell their story. Kim, the response was overwhelming. And over the last 12 hours, the stories have gone like this. My mother died at home. I went to the police department. They referred me to a funeral home. The funeral director hooked me up with a doctor who was a friend of the funeral home who signed off on a death certificate, and we cremated her right away. Another story of a man who was sent to the hospital. They didn't have room for him, so they sent him home. His daughter tells me they sent him to a second hospital. They ran out of power, and on the way to the third hospital, he died in an ambulance. Just before coming on the air with you, there was another story of a man who went to the hospital to dependent on oxygen. The first hospital ran out of oxygen, and he didn't make it to the second hospital. Mm. The people are coming out of the woodworks to tell their stories of their loved ones who have died and are not accounted for by the government. They're not one of those 64. And listen, let me also say this. I have found no evidence, nor has anyone come to me, saying that they have evidence of a government cover-up when it comes to the death toll.
Okay.
But I do know that the government has not gone out and asked questions. What they have said from the beginning is, here's our policy. You come to us, the doctor sends us a death certificate, he says it's storm-related, we evaluate it, and we stamp it. That's how it goes. And if the family disagrees with the doctor's assessment, they can ask us to do another investigation. What was different about the Harvard study was that they said, we are going to go out in the community and do outreach. We're going to randomly knock on doors. We're going to use a survey philosophy that has been used at other natural disasters around the world, and we're going to ask people about the deaths instead of having them come to us. I think that's a big difference.
All right, David, I want to get to some of our callers. Liz is on the line from Baltimore. Hi there, Liz.
Hi, Kim.
You're on with David Begno.
Yeah, so, great. Thank you both for your insights. I just wanted to add that in the wake of all this devastation, the real colonial treatment that Puerto Rico is facing with our governmental neglect, I think solar energy, renewable energy, community solar is a really exciting opportunity on the island, and Puerto Ricans have the answers. So many people and nonprofits are already doing this work and really giving power back to the people, both metaphorically and literally.
Thank you so much, Liz, for that call. And David, what do you think about that? What are Puerto Ricans themselves doing to repair from Hurricane Maria and to prepare for the next one?
Thank you, Liz, for bringing that up. We're actually on our way to Yabucoa right now to meet with an 88-year-old woman who has had solar panels installed at her home by the nonprofit group Samaritan's Purse. Listen, Kim, there have been a number of unsung heroes in this disaster, and they are the volunteers with the NGOs who have come in delivered things like solar panels and water filters and water tablets. What are people doing to get ready? They're doing everything you would assume, but I think what we've been seeing is not enough has been done. When you fly over this island, you see blue tarps all over the place. That's an indication that roofs are still not repaired. People are still relying on these temporary tarps that they've been given, and hurricane season starts in 24 hours.
So what do you see as the biggest obstacle now? Is it still infrastructure, the state of the roads, the ability for people to get the materials where they need to be? Is it manpower? What is the biggest issue right now?
Number one, the infrastructure is so delicate when it comes to the power grid. It goes out daily on a beautiful day with sunshine, Kim. Okay? When you drive around this island, many of the traffic lights still out. They're not on the ground. They're not on the road anymore, but they're still out. You still have volunteers helping to direct traffic. People are trying to get back to work and make money and also do what they can to rebuild and patchwork at their home. Remember, we have an island that's in bankruptcy. That hasn't changed yet. The island is sort of under the control of this fiscal board that has a lot of authority. The governor has been arguing with them. So you have the financial aspect of it all. And then you've got FEMA that essentially it's FEMA's responsibility, and they have been lambasted for a slow response after the storm. So what they have done is called us in and said, look, here's what we have at the ready. Here's what we've got ready to go. We will be faster. We will be quicker if and when, let's hope not, it happens again.
All right. David Begno is a correspondent for CBS News. He spoke to me from San Juan, Puerto Rico. David, thanks.
You're welcome.
When we come back, we dig deeper into that new Harvard study with one of the researchers who went to Puerto Rico for the recount. Call us. Do you think we, Washington, and the government in Puerto Rico have done enough to protect islanders from future storms? Is your family ready? I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator. In every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Listen every afternoon on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're looking back at Hurricane Maria and at a new study which puts the real death toll from that storm in the thousands. You can join the conversation. Did 64 dead ever seem believable to you after what we saw on TV? Do you wonder how officials in Washington and San Juan came up with that number? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, to find out more about how researchers who worked on that new Harvard study came up with a death toll of over 70 times higher than the official count, we turn to one of the researchers themselves. Nishant Kishore is a graduate student at Harvard School of Public Health and one of the authors of the study. He spent 2 weeks in January in Puerto Rico doing the actual field work that went into the study, and he joins me from Fort Smith, Arkansas. Nishant, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the methodology you used in coming up with a number so starkly different than the official count.
Sure. What we looked at was sort of all-cause mortality, so people that died for any reason. We developed a representative sample of 3,299 households across the island in 104 different barrios in the island as well. And we went out, developed a procedure through which we used satellite imagery and that type of data to identify households at random. And we went walking through the towns and through the barrios, knocking on households. Basically, once we got there, we would ask, hey, would you like to participate in the study? How many people lived here in the year of 2017? And did people move out? Did people move in? And did anybody die in the entire year? We also asked questions about access to resources, lack of access to medical care, access to utilities, so on and so forth. And then we aggregated all this data about over 9,000 people and evaluated the mortality rate, the crude mortality rate, for the period after the hurricane in 2017. So from September 20th through December 31st of that year.
And that's quite a period of time. How did you come to settle on that time frame to come up with this this final count?
Sure. It's, you know, death is a rare event, and we wanted to make sure that we could capture things over a large period of time. We also understood that there was continued lack of access to utilities, so we were really interested in seeing, did the hurricane come, have an effect immediately, and then go away, or could we actually see something happening over time? Did death change just for the first month and then stop? So we really were interested in that period afterwards, and since we were going in January, we could sort of collect reliably that information through December.
And one of our callers, Brian, who is calling from St. Croix, Virgin Islands, has a question about that mortality rate. Hi, Brian. Thanks for calling today.
Hello, Kim. Thank you. Your previous guest, David, mentioned something about the area being forgotten. So I guess I wanted to start with my first comment being, please don't forget about the Virgin Islands, too. Even this show about Maria hasn't yet mentioned the Virgin Islands. We had the same storm at the same time and are going through all of the same problems. But that said, I did want to, I guess, shine a light on the fact that that vastly different number does have a lot to do with the fact that the method for counting what was considered a storm mortality is vastly different from what the government has previously used. Like, I think in Hugo, the mortality rate for the Virgin Islands was in the single digits. I think it would have been much higher had the Harvard studies methodologies been considered. So some of the huge difference is methodological. It's, I think, worth noting.
And Brian, before we go back to Nishant, I just want to ask, how are you and your family doing there?
Every day is a little bit better, but you know, we were one of the lucky ones without significant damage to our house. But all across St. Croix, you still see blue tarps of people that don't have their roofs on yet. We haven't had phone service or internet service restored yet, but we had our electricity back. We were one of the lucky ones. We were only out for about 65 or 70 days.
Wow. Well,
but when you call that lucky, that does put it in perspective.
Indeed. Brian, thank you so much for that call today. And Nishant, talk a little bit about that methodology. Can people really be confident in death tolls that we hear from official sources?
Sure. Like the other caller mentioned, they are two different estimates. The 64 deaths that were reported earlier rely on actual death certificates with notations on them that say this was a cause because of the hurricane. What we found was that this mortality rate was elevated for the months past the hurricane itself. And so we included all-cause mortality, so not just individuals that died from debris or high-force winds or what have you, but people that lacked access to medical care and died later. And we compared this to the same period in 2016 to see if there was any difference in the mortality rate between those two time points.
So there are lots of different causes of death, Nishant. How did you break down what is attributable to Hurricane Maria, whether they're illnesses or injuries, or how did you make that definition?
Sure. We didn't. So essentially, we have ones such as fire, trauma, drownings, things that have been sort of long recognized as things that are directly caused by a hurricane. But we evaluated all deaths with the idea being that something changed between 2016 and 2017. And if there is a difference, there's this one big factor that likely contributed to that difference. And so this estimate of excess deaths, this estimate of excess mortality is based off of the fact that realistically the mortality rate in Puerto Rico has been generally stable for the past decade or so, we wouldn't expect to see a large deviation from the mortality rate in 2016 compared to 2017.
Amber is on the line, calling from St. Thomas, Virgin Islands. Amber, thank you for calling.
Hi, Kim. Thank you. I'm, you know, devastated like so many. We were so thankful to the Puerto Ricans. They helped us greatly after Irma. And then, of course, St. Croix and Puerto Rico got hit by Maria. I wanted to make, you know, also say, yes, please don't forget the forgotten Americans, the Puerto Ricans, U.S. Virgin Islanders. But also make the point to maybe some statesiders that may not realize it's not just a matter of means. Why, you know, things haven't been done. Why, when you look across these islands, you see nothing but seas of blue tarp roofs. Even those of us that have money, funds to get supplies, we're on back order. We are waiting long periods of time to even get supplies. So our contractor told us 5 months ago there'd be no way we could create a new hurricane shelter in time for this storm season. We've been waiting 5 months to get new shutters. We waited 2.5 months to get guttering so we could even catch water. So, you know, we're working hard. We're doing what we can. But it's a matter of even just getting the supplies to us to get prepared and get ready for this next season.
Wow, Amber.
Which is tomorrow.
Right, tomorrow the new hurricane season begins. Amber, thank you so much for calling. Nishant, sort of on that note, can you talk about some of the stories you heard in Puerto Rico as you and your colleagues were conducting this story, this study? What stories did you hear about how people survived or didn't survive the storm?
Generally speaking, there was large numbers of households that had lack of access to electricity and running water and even cell phone coverage. Lots of individuals, lots of places we went to still didn't have electricity when we actually got there. And, you know, everyone had a story to tell. I'm hesitant to say specific ones as we don't want to identify individuals that are
sure.
households that are part of the study.
Right, Nishant Kishore is one of the authors of the new Harvard study on the death toll from last September's Hurricane Maria. Nishant, thank you for your time.
Thanks.
Well, to dig deeper into how that storm impacted the people of the island and how ready Puerto Ricans are for the next storm and how government officials in Washington and San Juan have performed through all of this, we turn to Van Newkirk in Washington. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic covering politics and policy, and he has reported extensively on Puerto Rico. Van, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So to start off, were you surprised by the findings from this Harvard study?
So I don't know if I was surprised. I think we all knew that the official count was definitely a dramatic undercount. And I'd seen some estimates based on comparing periodical death rates and reports that ranged in the low thousands. So this was higher than some of the stuff that I'd seen. But based on just talking to people and asking them if they'd known somebody who had died in a way related to the storm, they died from, you know, if they were elderly and they died from not being able to get medical care or if they were on dialysis and couldn't get their dialysis. You see quite a few people, pretty much everybody I talked to had somebody they knew who was going through that situation. So if you do the math from there, you can easily get a number that's in the thousands.
And tell our listeners, in your reporting, how do you break down who is responsible, first of all, for this happening? Is it federal officials? Is it folks that are local in Puerto Rico or in the local towns? And who bears the most responsibility for ensuring, as a new hurricane season begins tomorrow, this won't happen again?
So the most, I think, easy to point out example of where things went wrong was the federal response. And anybody, even people in the federal disaster preparedness and response agencies will tell you that the United States did not do a good job at responding to Hurricane Maria, at making sure the island was prepared for hurricane season, and probably still have some of the same deficiencies going into hurricane season tomorrow. You could see things just from the rhetoric from the president, the paper towel roll throws, the fact that it took so long for some of the official infrastructure of the response to get there, and the spiraling the fallout with repairing the power grid. But beyond that, you know, there's enough, more than enough blame to go around everybody. There was the territorial government didn't do a great job at being prepared. And also part of the power line restoration is on them in PREPA. And also you have the financial board who has jurisdiction over financial matters and over some of the infrastructure. But then you also have decades and decades of just the federal policy towards Puerto Rico, which makes it, I think, a uniquely not resilient place. You need to build in lots and lots of redundancies. You have to have capital to do that. You have to have a good infrastructure to do that. You have to have people who are sort of capable of who have the means to prepare themselves, who aren't living just above poverty. And you got to have the will and people who care. And a lot of those things were just not present in any mainland policy towards Puerto Rico for years. So you have an island that's uniquely at risk for hurricanes sitting in the Caribbean, and you have no dedicated real federal policy orientation towards meeting that vulnerability. This what happened with Hurricane Maria was devastating but utterly predictable in a way.
And so I want to get your reaction from a headline from the Associated Press, which says that the Puerto Rico grid is still teetering despite $3.8 billion being put in to repair it, making it almost a guarantee that more blackouts will happen in another storm. How is that possible?
Well, I think David, he mentioned earlier, you know, he talked about the restoration of the power grid isn't building, you know, we aren't at the stage yet of building a power grid that is more resilient than the last one. And the last one was pretty bad. People had blackouts during regular storms. When I was there before and after this, the Hurricane Maria, the big one, you saw people having blackouts for regular seasonal activity, for winds, for heavy rainfall. So, and I don't think the grid is quite at that level yet. You are rebuilding with broken poles, with the same infrastructure, equipment, and pieces that were downed during Maria. So it seems pretty a lot of what's been doing is not capacity increasing, but mm-hmm. capacity restoring or rebuilding. And they aren't quite at the capacity they were before Maria in lots of places. So it seems if you, like David said, if you get a tropical storm, even a strong depression come through there, you're going to see lots of people without power and in the same type of situation they've been in for months.
All right. I want to get some callers in here. Luis is calling from Needham, Massachusetts. Thanks for the call, Luis.
Hi, Kim. Yeah, I just wanted to say that for many of us who are, my parents are from Puerto Rico. I have a brother who lives there. We had to take my mom away from there after the storm. We were fortunate to do that. It's really a confirmation. The federal response has been a confirmation of how this Puerto Rico is a colony. And there was no sense of urgency part of the federal government. They don't really know what to do with these Spanish-speaking American citizens that live in this Caribbean island. And that's what's been sad. But in some ways, I think it's opened to everybody's eyes of Puerto Rico's colonial status as their second-class citizen. That's my comment.
Well, Luis, thank you for the comment. Van, what do you think about that?
I think that's spot on. You look at the underpinnings of the United States judicial and legal orientation towards Puerto Rico and the other territories. They're based on Supreme Court rulings about a century ago that basically say that Puerto Rican people are not capable of the same type of sovereignty as people on the mainland. And lots of the laws, the lack of ability for the lack of power with the Puerto Rican territorial government to be able to respond to things, and also things like having a lower Medicaid match rate. Those are all legacies of what was created in 100 years ago.
And just in the couple seconds before we break, Van, how much, if at all, does race play an issue here?
Well, I think race plays a big issue. And actually, you look at even in Puerto Rico, race plays an issue within who was hit hardest and who is suffering from the fallout. There are people who are considered to, you know, more obvious African descent on places on the island, and they tend to live near the big power plant. So there's also a divide within Puerto Rico, but a big one between Puerto Ricans and the mainland.
We're talking about Puerto Rico and how that island has recovered or not recovered since Hurricane Maria and what needs to be done. You can join the conversation. What needs to change in the way Washington and Puerto Rico do business? And what do our emergency management officials in Puerto Rico and here on the mainland need to do now to keep people safe in the coming months as a new hurricane season comes to the Caribbean? I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Didn't you just make that up?
Well, yeah. I just...
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're talking about Puerto Rico, the U.S. territory, and how it's preparing for the coming hurricane season. You can join the conversation. Have we on the mainland done what needs to be done for Puerto Rico? Is another disaster around the corner? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest is Van Newkirk, staff writer at The Atlantic, covering politics and policy, who has written a lot on Puerto Rico. You can find a link to his most recent story on our website, onpointradio.org. Now, Van, I want to ask you to explain the difference in the response in Puerto Rico and the other U.S. territories after Maria to the response on the mainland. We heard the president and others attribute that primarily to geography. These are islands, after all. But is that the main reason that we saw what appears to be a difference in the response there?
Well, there is a point to the fact that Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, are islands. They're more remote. They're more difficult to get to by nature. They have fewer and less well-updated pieces of the infrastructure that are needed to put up the kind of forward bases for both the military and the public health services corps. And especially Puerto Rico is mountainous and very difficult to get to on the interior. So that makes some of the most remote places very difficult to get aid. And they would have been hard to aid in the immediate aftermath of any storm under pretty much any circumstances. With that said, I don't think anybody will tell you that what happened in the response to Maria was say, on par with the response to Hurricane Harvey in the Gulf. There were, you know, immediate plans put in place. There were disaster prep scenarios. There were people, the Public Health Services Corps all came out and deployed where they were. You know, there was a plan. There was a plan. People knew the plan, and it was enacted immediately. When you saw people getting their FEMA assistance for their housing, there was a process that was set up. It fails for everybody at some point, not for somebody at some point everywhere, but it worked generally in the Gulf. You saw that FEMA process totally fall apart in Puerto Rico especially. You saw a bafflingly slow response in moving some assets, like the Comfort ship to off the coast, to moving some more military assets. And then once people started moving, a complete lack of organization and confusion as to what to do, as to where the critical assets were, and basically as to what the long-term mission of lots of these moving pieces were. Again, it's hard to compare these. It's kind of apples and oranges because the infrastructure is so fragile. You don't have, the federal government isn't really responsible, doesn't really have to worry about repairing an entire electrical grid in Houston.
Right.
And it does in Puerto Rico. So these are sort of different challenges, but I think you can say we were much more prepared and efficient in responding to Harvey and other mainland disasters than we were in responding to Maria.
Van, you mentioned FEMA. I want to play a PSA. Earlier this month, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, put out this PSA encouraging Puerto Ricans to take immediate steps to prepare for this summer's hurricane and to stay alive. To get out the message, FEMA turned to Cleveland Indians coach and Hall of Famer Sandy Alomar and the team's owner, Paul Dolan.
Hello, Puerto Rico. During both the baseball season and the hurricane season, we need to be ready.
This year, preparedness has to be 10 times stronger.
Make sure to have 10 days worth of water, canned food, medication, and other supplies.
Be informed and follow your local officials to stay on top of all hurricane-related updates.
This hurricane season, hit a home run and be prepared.
From what you've seen in your reporting, Van, would warnings like this have been helpful before Maria? And do you think that this is what's needed now?
I think before and after Maria, compared to mainland Americans, Puerto Ricans were pretty well prepared for disasters. You see, because there are regular sort of interruptions of services already, people understand how to go without electricity. You know, you don't have one big marker of preparedness is the fact that everybody already had generators. You have people who are used to having boil water advisories on their local water sources and who have the infrastructure built in their homes to collect fresh water when municipal water sources aren't working for them. Those things are already built into daily life, and especially since Maria, have been built into daily routines for people. So actually, I don't know if a warning to be more prepared and more resilient is going to really help some of the underlying things. You know, what does preparedness do for you if you're living in a under a blue tarp roof and a hurricane comes and blows that roof away?
Yeah, here's a couple comments from our website. Min says, will there ever be a show about the U.S. Virgin Islands? Can NPR even fathom the thought of committing more than 5 minutes to this, the discussion of St. Thomas, St. John, St. Croix, which were hit by two Category 5 storms? We, of course, thank our callers who have called in from St. Thomas and St. Croix today as we talk about this study on Puerto Rico. Also, Sandra says, the speaker says these are Americans. The missing word is rich. If they'd been rich Americans, the response might have been better. Those who are lesser will get a roll of paper towels tossed at them. Problem solved. I want to get to some callers. Fernando is calling from Clearwater, Florida. Hello.
Hello, Kim. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, Fernando. You're on.
Yes. I lived in Puerto Rico in the 80s. And I have in-laws that still live there. And back in the 80s, we even had infrastructure problems where water would go out, the electricity would go out. But I think your guest hit it on the nose is that you have to understand the culture of the Puerto Rican people. And I don't think the federal government and most journalists don't, is that they are passive people and they're not going to go out and protest in the streets like Americans do. And so they've accept things that most Americans won't. For example, I remember at the hospital, you would have to bring your own blankets, your own pillows, if you're going to be hospitalized. To make a doctor's appointment, you would have to wake up at 7 in the morning and stand in line. And you would see people 20, 30 deep waiting for the office to open up. These are things that nobody talks about, and both parties have been negligent in the infrastructure, and they've never improved it. And so I think the first step is understanding the culture of these Puerto Rican people and then address their issues that way.
Well, Fernando, thank you for that call. Van, I want to talk a little bit about that, the cultural issues. Of course, we have seen some people protesting in the streets in Puerto Rico, but how does culture play in? How did you see that playing in your reporting?
Well, I think that there's a good point there in that, again, people in Puerto Rico have, I think, a different underlying baseline sense of what it means to be prepared. There are lots of daily disasters and daily consequences where things don't work that somebody living in Washington, D.C. just has no idea how to deal with. And so people build those things into their understanding of what life is like. It's right. I was in hospitals where they don't, you know, they ran out of prescription drugs. You can't imagine that happening in, say, a George Washington hospital in D.C.
Right.
But people just sort of deal and have lots of different layers of assistance built into their lives. I think people, and this is comparable to lots of people who are lower income and communities of color across the United States, there's more, I think, community awareness of where your neighbors, where your brothers and sisters are. And what I saw after the storm was people, these amazingly robust community networks, family networks that were still finding a way to transmit information without power, without cell phone service. People are still getting messages out. And it was an incredible effort of willpower. Mm-hmm. Actually, one of the most successful and effective ways of tracking people was put together by Univision. Totally ad hoc series of people just reporting on what was happening in their neighborhood, where their family members were. And this was how I was getting news about, you know, what was happening in different places right after the storm, was these people who were fighting for their lives found time and energy to report on what was going on to save other people. And it was just this incredible coming together.
Well, Van, there's a lot spoken about not just the infrastructure as it exists in Puerto Rico, but also the debt situation. In just the short time that we have left, talk a little bit about how that is impacting both recovery and preparedness efforts.
Well, one thing I always say is that debt is infrastructure, or lack thereof. It influences everything, and also most of what we consider to be infrastructure, the power grid, municipal services like water, trash delivery. Those are things that all basically form the majority of the debt here. So if there's, you know, many billion dollars of debt on the island, it has been a major barrier for any new construction, for improving the infrastructure, period. So there's a new policy in place, has been in place for 2 years now, called PROMESA, which is trying to grapple with that debt by putting together what's basically an austerity program.
Mm-hmm.
But what we know about austerity is that it does not really have a whole lot of room for, you know, throwing money at improving water, electricity, things like that. And so when you're this deep in debt, you have to pay off creditors. Where does the money come from for hurricane season 2018?
And that's questions that that officials are asking right now. Van Newkirk is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He joined me from Washington. Van, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, last week, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, issued its forecast for the new hurricane season, which officially starts tomorrow. Joining me from College Park, Maryland, is the lead seasonal hurricane forecaster at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, Jerry Bell. Jerry, welcome to On Point.
Oh, hi, Kim. Sure. It's great to be here.
And we appreciate you joining us. So overall, what can we expect from this year's hurricane season, and particularly how it will affect the Caribbean islands like Puerto Rico?
Well, this year we're predicting a near or above normal Atlantic hurricane season. And unfortunately, that means the potential for a lot of activity again this year. Overall, we're expecting 10 to 16 named storms, of which 5 to 9 we're thinking could become hurricanes, and 1 to 4 of those could become major hurricanes. So certainly if the activity is toward the higher ends of our predicted ranges, that would be another above normal season.
So what variables are you looking at to come to this conclusion of a potentially active hurricane season?
Well, it turns out that there's a strong scientific basis for making these seasonal outlooks. And the reason is that there's a couple of dominant climate patterns that very strongly control the wind and air pressure patterns and ocean temperature patterns across the tropical Atlantic and Caribbean Sea. And so by predicting those patterns, we can often indicate what the likely activity will be for the season. This year, we're expecting a no El Nino or La Nina, which means we're not expecting El Nino to really suppress the season. We're also expecting near-average Atlantic ocean temperatures. And the third factor is that we've been in a high-activity period for Atlantic hurricanes since 1995. So those background conditions that are favoring more storms, we're expecting to be in place this year. So it's really that combination of three factors this year that is why we're thinking near or above normal season.
And Jerry, you mentioned that there's been a high activity since 1995. How, if at all, does climate change come into play here?
Well, that is not an issue of climate change. It turns out that one of the patterns we look at, and here's, it's a fancy name, it's called the Atlantic Multi-Decadal Oscillation, or AMO. The historical record for Atlantic hurricanes really reflects this multi-decadal oscillation. And what that means is that this climate pattern, it's a well-known pattern, occurs in a certain phase for anywhere from 25 to 40 years at a time, producing more active seasons, and then it switches phase and it produces less active seasons. So, for example, it was in the phase that we have now back in the late 1800s to about 1900, then again from 1950 to 1970, very active, and again since 1995, another high activity era. In between, the early part of the 1900s were really below normal seasons, and from 1971 to 1994, half of those seasons were below normal. So that's how powerful this pattern is, and it's one of the climate patterns that very strongly controls the activity, not only for decades at a time, but one year to the next as well.
Jerry, not just in terms of the potential power of these storms, but just how many we may have. The Atlantic Tropical Cyclone names have been released. They go from Alberto, Beryl, Chris and Debbie, all the way down to Valerie and William. How deep into this list of names are you expecting us to get?
Well, 10 to 16 named storms is what we're predicting. Likely, and we give that with a 70% chance of occurrence. So whatever the 16th name on the list would be, that's what we're predicting up to that level of activity this year.
Okay, Jerry Bell is lead seasonal hurricane forecaster at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center. He spoke to me from College Park, Maryland. Jerry, thanks for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Kim.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Bryman Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poley, Catherine Proctor, Tanya Rowley, Jeremy Relosa, and James Ross. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Coming up tomorrow, reviving the Singapore summit and more from our panel. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.